Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Well, it's being this time of the year when we celebrate the Christ child. So I'm going to read to you out of Matthew this morning. And the words may seem, because we're not too accustomed to the Bible and some of this stuff, why it's difficult. I mean, the words. Anyway, all these things spake Jesus unto the multitude in parables, and without a parable spake he not unto them. Then Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house. And his disciples came unto him, saying, Declare unto us the parable of the tares in the field. And he answered them and said unto them, He that soweth the good seed is the Son of Man. Now, don't put it out there someplace, you know. The field is the world. The good seed are the children of the kingdom, but the tares are the children of the wicked one. You see, this is where the language gets difficult. The enemy that sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers are the angels. As therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall it be in the end of the world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend them, which do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire, and there shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who hath ears to hear, let him hear. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a treasure hid in a field, the which, when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath, and buyeth that field. To many people, the sayings of Jesus and some of the passages of the Bible are rather puzzling, to say the least. The synoptics, you know, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the first three books of the Gospels, of the Good News, they agree to some extent with each other. And that's why they're called synoptics. They're all looking out of one eye. They agree. But then we come to John, and it's as if he's standing all by himself. He has an entirely different way of looking at things. The Last Supper, for instance, John dates as the day preceding Passover. And it's called the Day of Preparation. The synoptics, however, they identify the Last Supper as the Passover meal, It's a Seder service. If one is to sit down and study these synoptics and John and then the Acts and so on, you know, and all the variations of the theme that is found in the Gospels, an historical reconstruction of what actually happened is almost impossible. They differ so. So the question then, what becomes important then, is maybe not what actually happened moment by moment, but what is this whole thing pointing to? Some of the statements are strange. And the more one turns them over in one's mind, the stranger they become. Church historians and theologians have offered explanations. But again, there are those who do not accept these explanations as their tonic, so to speak. So it comes down to we should wrestle with these sayings for ourselves and by ourselves. It's sort of like being given a corn. You're given a corn before your mother and father were, what was your original face? That's the original koan of them all. And now we could take one out of these Gospels and say, it's a very strange saying at the Passover supper, at the Last Supper, when Jesus broke the bread and he passed the bread around and he says, "Here, this is my body." Now, don't you think that's a strange saying? What did he mean? Yeah. The more one struggles with these words honestly, now, not just accepting this and that and the other, but honestly, you know, one recognizes that they're kind of like if you were drilling a hole with a diamond bit. Drill away with this diamond bit. It grinds away everything that it touches. Every explanation you come up with and every one you have read. What is the meaning? What is the true meaning? And under this kind of pressure within yourself, historical reasons and philosophical reasons, you know, they become sort of like a fine dust that you can, and they're gone. When this fine dust that we have created with this drill in our minds, in our hearts, this barrier to cognition, blown away, comes a little gap, comes a little slit through which light enters. So understanding emerges in us, under the understanding that passeth reasoning. Understanding rises in us when this diamond cutter, this diamond bit, has been allowed to do his work. Now, in wrestling, of course, with some of these sayings of Jesus, we have the problem of language. Translations usually do not bring with it the essence of the meaning. A translation usually takes place through the conditioning of the one who is doing the translating. And of course, through his particular culture then, because that's his conditioning, isn't it? Yeah. So translations sometimes are only very rough approximations. So we can take the word, like in Chinese, the word Ming is translated to mean fate. Or we have the word, the Chinese word Jin, which is translated as human-heartedness. Well, in a way, it's true. That's what they mean. But the exactness is not with it. As you know very well, that if you have learned a foreign language or if you speak a language other than English, you know how difficult it is sometimes to translate a word. We have the word in English to represent, and in German it is Ausdruck, and that has a little different connotation to it than just represents. You know, it's kind of like here in America, we could cook a duck. It would be cooked in an American way. It's duck. It's how we're accustomed to it. But it's, see, it wouldn't be quite, it would be duck, but it would not be quite like Peking duck. Huh? See, there's that slight subtle difference in there. The subtlety of taste, as it were, is different. See, so that what really matters, the essence of the thing, doesn't come with the translation. And so we look at all these words, and we wrestle with these words, and we let this, shall we call it, diamond cutter in us, work. And then we find one day that we have reached a state of consciousness that allows us to understand certain things. I mean, each state, you know, as we go through and understand the state, we understand more and more of what is said. For instance, Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Well, now this is crazy. Who wants to be poor in spirit? We all want to be rich in spirit, don't we? Yeah, so what is this poorness? What is it to be poor in spirit? It's a tremendous state of consciousness, is poor in spirit. But you're not going to know that until you go to work on the thing. And work. Now, Stephen Crane, you probably know, yeah, you know about him. He wrote poetry. And he wrote at one time, a man said to the universe, sir, I exist. That's what we say to the universe very often. I exist. Look at me. However, replied the universe, the fact has not created in me a sense of obligation. That's something we must learn. Now, a given one, any individual, you know, can live a life that we would call a good life. It's filled with seeking and goodness and beauty and tranquility and security and all your other goals. Or a given one can live a life that we would call ugly. Whichever you choose, the universe is not obligated in any way. That's your choice. We are left in this instance the freedom to live and to choose. In one sense of the word, we have a great deal of freedom. In one sense of the word, we have practically none. This is a tremendous paradox. We're free, and yet we have no freedom. Our freedom from within, in the inner core of us, in the center of us, you know, nothing is forced. No. We can either follow that which is within us and allow it to mature, or we can ignore it. That we're free to do. To this extent. Because we are free to choose the maturing of ourselves or not, there is a tremendous beauty in the adventure of going within. The adventure itself, there is such beauty there, present, and then this beauty of arriving to it in the different stages. But you have to choose. Your choice, your choices in this world determine your personality. Your choices determine the content of your psyche. The ambience in which you live is because of your choice. So your choice of what you do becomes your destiny. When you reach the end of this span of time, that which you are then is what you have created by choosing. Every step, every moment, you have to decide, and no one can decide it for you. You have to decide in which direction you're going to move. It's beautiful. We are not born a fixed entity. We are born simply a potential, a tremendous potential to be sure, but potential. And so we create ourselves psychologically, moment by moment, as best we can with what we've got to work with. See, and that's the, takes away the freedom. Yeah. But we are born as a seed, not yet a tree. You know Meister Eckhart's old thing, you know, about pear seeds become pear trees, and apple seeds become apple trees, and God seeds become what? We are seeds, not yet a tree. How you decide what to do with a seed is your destiny. If you live so that you can become total, more at one, you know, then you have religion in your life. A religious life is a flowing life. Jesus at the well and speaks to the woman from Samaria. He tells her this. I will give you living water, the flowing water, and you will never thirst again. You know, if you really turn in this, you know, it's her choice to this religion. And in a religious life, there is a wholeness in it. There's a one-pointedness in it. There is an inner alertness in it. So we could call it a life of inner prayer, this inner alertness. You know, first of all, we bump up against our conditioning immediately. You know. Saying a prayer is getting down on your knees and repeating something. Some words. Prayer is something you become, little by little. It's something that you live. It's something that surrounds you. It's like a very deep gratitude. You know, you're looking at the sparkling stars in the sky, you know, at night, and the moon that was so bright, you know, after the rain this past week, you know. Kimmy was so excited. She'd seen it for the first time. She had seen it over and over and over again, but for the first time she saw it. You look at the ocean. Have you really ever seen it? Look at the grass in the morning. You know, the sun is shining on all the sparkling little dewdrops. Something rises in us. There is a delight in just seeing this. Yeah, how excited Kimmy was. She saw it. The delight of it. And then, of course, there is with that simply this urge to say, thank you. And this is an inner prayer. This feeling. When one experiences the state of not knowing, with all of our knowing, you know, all of a sudden there is this state of not knowing. And the beauty of it, you know, we realize the innocence of it. And again, a thank you rises. And that's an inner prayer. An inner prayer is feeling and recognizing this unknown presence and the awe and the reverence with which we greet this unknown presence. And then becoming established, you know, in it and in the inner breath. Now, all of that is not something that you do. You don't sit there and clack your beads and say, okay, this is the 10th bead, now this is going to happen. That's going to happen. It's not something that you do, huh? And then, you know, after you've done it, then you're finished with it all. It's quite on the contrary. It's something that you grow into, and it goes on and on and on, and it's the way you live. Like breathing goes on and on and on, or you don't live. It's like the beating of the heart goes on and on. You know, something resides, something has taken up residence here. Something has taken residence in my house. And so my house has become a house of prayer. There is an urge in us. We're hungry for something. You don't even have any words for it. And you don't even know to whom you say thank you. You don't know how the morning or the evening or the night or the stars or the moon or how any of it has come about. Not knowing what is hidden in every leaf of grass, in every leaf of a tree. What is shining in every dewdrop. You don't know it all. ignorant. But we can say thank you. We can let it rise in us, you know. Just thank you. Now, on the other side, the word sin is used very often in the Bible. Now, sin comes from the Egyptian. The Egyptian goddess of the night was called Sin. And so Moses, he goes out to the desert and he's, you know, he goes up the mountain and he comes back down and he finds all these people sinning. You know, the fatted calf and of gold that they had created there, and they were all having this tremendous feast and drinking and carousing and everything. Sin. All the while he was up on the mountain talking to God. So we have Mount Sinai, and we have the Sinai Desert, and they're named for her. The night is dark, and darkness is to be feared, they thought. You know, so sin. Sin happens in the night. Now, when Adam, aren't you glad I don't go in the Bible very often? Easier to do then. When Adam ate from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, yeah, he sinned, they said. And he was thrown out of the Garden of Eden. So we could regard sin as an unethical act or an offense against a personal deity. In other systems of thought, such as the Buddhism, you don't find the word sin very often because they don't have a personal divinity. No. In the Greek, to sin simply meant to miss the mark. You set for yourself a certain thing and you miss the mark. Yeah. You sit for, meditate for an hour and you think at the end of the hour something should have happened to you and you didn't get it, so you missed the mark. Sin in the religious sects around the world has many interpretations, all the way from lying and cheating to dancing to playing cards. Whether or not you button or tie your shoes, depending on which religious sect you belong to. But implied in the Adam-Eve story, that myth, that having eaten of the fruit of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is our duality, is where we live, we have eaten of this fruit, so according to that story, we are living in sin. So we must become children again. We must become one again with ourselves. We must come back to this garden state. We drop the fruit for a moment and become innocent. That is, uncorrupted by our knowledge. Or you can't get back in. To taste of the fruit of the tree of life. Now, let us also remember that the garden did not reject us. And the garden is not obligated to take us in again just because I am who I am. Any rejection or thought along this line, we create for ourselves. We miss the mark when we act in a cunning manner. Cunningness. We lie to ourselves. Oh, I know this, and I know that, and I know the other thing. If you knew it, you would hide it. When we are self-complacent, when we feel that we are enough unto ourselves, when we choose to ignore that in us which wishes to be known, we reject ourselves. Nothing else. Nothing else. Speaking of Adam and Eve, I received a magazine the other day from England. And it seems that a group of scientists have formed an organization. And there is the thought in this organization that Adam stems from Eve, not Eve from Adam as we have it. They've got it all turned around. These are scientists now. Women first. Not a man first. What? No. They're men. That man really is only a secondary appendage. How about that, huh? They have figured out a whole new system. Men are not necessary at all. There is such a thing as parthenogenesis. Now, a woman can have a baby just for herself. How do you think the Christ child was born? What is this virgin and child? Anyway, I thought you'd get a kick out of the thing. You know, these scientists, actually what they're after is they don't see the need for sex. Why did it come about in this world? That's their scientific thing. How did it come about in this world? Tell them very simply, it's a creativity of God. What more you want to know? Find God and you'll find out why. Yeah? Now, so much for sin and Adam and Eve. Good. Now we come to the quality of good. It's difficult to talk about this because, you know, there is no such thing as good without bad. There is no way in the world that you can pick up only one end of a stick. Try it. I like this end of the stick, it's good, and I don't want that end of the stick, it's bad. This end of the stick is hot. I like things hot. That end of the stick is cold. I don't like things cold. How are you going to pick up one end of the stick? So difficult then to talk about good. Now, but let us say that goodness is the quality of an act that comes out of our totality. If we were in a state of consciousness that was total, and then there was an act, we could call that good, for some. And in this way, when one has the experience of the love that is God. There's no bad connected with that. There is no duality in it. It completely transcends our duality. So that one can say, love in that aspect is good. And Jesus says in the Bible, you know, that God is love. He does not say God is loving. He says he is love. When love rises in us, our kind of love, huh, which is a kind of a backwash of what he is, you know, when this love rises in us, you know, in the heart. Inner prayer, we could call it. But when that love itself, wells up in the heart, then you know it as an aspect of God, and you know it. And Jesus did say, none but the Father is good. That love is good. And that's the only thing that he could apply good to. Everything else is good and bad. Only the Father is good. That love, he separates it so neatly from what we know as love. You understand? Gee, I'm talking to myself. I don't need this. I already know this. Anyway, then we come to the devil. I'm just trying to explain these few little lines. Now, that comes from the Sanskrit. It comes from Deva, which means a shining one. The angel Lucifer, he separated himself from God, from good, from love. Now we're taught to think of Lucifer as Satan. He's the devil. He sinned, you know. He left the Father. Lucifer, which means bright as the morning star. They also speak of Lucifer as another name for the planet Venus. He's the morning star that shines. And in Isaiah we find these words, how art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, who didst weaken the nations? Who made the world like a wilderness? Remember what the world is, huh? Who made the world like a wilderness and destroyed its city? Who opened not the house of his prisoners? You know, which is simply saying, look, what are prisoners to you? The things you've got imprisoned in here that you won't look at and won't let out. The content of your psyche. And in Revelations, again, we find this, I am the root and the offspring of David. I am the bright morning star. The root and the offspring. Now, again, we come to something very difficult here. How can the Father be the Son? How can the Son be the Father? The root and the offspring. The Buddha, sitting under the tree in India, 500 years before Jesus made his appearance, you know, and he sat there and he had this perfect enlightenment. And he got up and he said, I have seen the bright morning star. Yeah. Lucifer. Satan. No. One of the very early popes was named Lucifer. Lucifer was held in great esteem until Milton wrote his poem wherein he called him the devil. It changed things. You know, it's like Shakespeare with some of the stuff he wrote changed things for us so much. You know, in the 4th century, there was a Christian sect known as the Luciferians. They were the followers of Lucifer. But not the devil, but the bright morning star. Now, Lucifer left the father. He had a quarrel with the father. He left him. So here we have this separation. So this is where they began to build this in, you know, that it was sin. Lucifer was sin. He was Satan because he separated himself from the father. It's like our thinking separates us from what we are. It is God that unites. Now, I remember, too, they're just ways of speaking. Different cultures, you know. And also, Lucifer and God are not entities. We don't have to be children any longer, you know, to believe in these personages. And this is difficult for us. We are conditioned in this culture that God is a person, that the devil is a person. To divorce yourself from that is more difficult than you think. That sitting in here, regardless of what goes on up here, it's sitting in here in the subconscious where it has drifted and has become a prisoner. Thinking mind creates fragments. You can't think total. You think in pieces, in parcels. And so we have nations and races and high and low and hot and cold and near and far. This is how we think. It's the only way we can think. By dividing so we can analyze. When we are total, you know, when it's all one, you know, in that totality, there is no separateness. And there is good without any bad. Actually, there's neither. Because if you take away bad, you take away good, don't you? Yeah, so something transcends. And Plato finally came to it, and he says, well, let's call it beauty. But to act out of that state, you know, is to be religious. Now, all these things spake Jesus unto the multitude in parables. And without a parable spake he not unto them. Now, a parable is something that stands side by side. Huh? It's a way of saying something from the heart. It's a way of talking in a picture language, you know, image creating. If I say to you, oh, there's a wheat field, and there are weeds growing in the field along with the wheat, that's easy to image. His language is a little different. He uses tares. So we have to go to the dictionary and find out what tares are. But he's trying to create this bridge with his picture language between himself and those to whom he's speaking, between himself and the unconscious of you. We being children, understand pictures. Yeah. We live out pictures. We have, at night when we dream, we have whole sets of pictures. That's how your unconscious talks to you, is in picture language. And they have a strange way of changing before us, all the while we're dreaming. They shift so suddenly, these pictures. The unconscious understands pictures. Why do you think it's so hard to let go of this picture that we have of the baby, the Christ child? You know, it's way down in the unconscious. The conscious mind is trained for words. When a preacher, when a preacher talks, he talks in concepts. Huh? Yeah. He is trying to communicate from one head to another head. Yeah? But with Jesus, with the Buddha, and with men of that ilk, the stories they told, trying to communicate from an inner depth to an inner depth. Then you don't need logic for understanding. What you need is understanding. And then you could listen with a deep trust, because he had something to say. He did. We just don't understand what it is he had to say. Yeah, now here are these disciples. They've been with him quite a long while already, and they're supposed to know a little bit of something. So he's telling parables to the multitudes, and then he sends all the multitudes away, and he goes back in the house, and the disciples come to him and say, "What are you talking about? What do you mean? What's the significance of the parable? We want to understand. The weeds are growing together with the wheat. Let them grow together until the harvest. Then gather the weeds, bundle them up, and set fire to them." That's what he said. When the time comes, when there is a degree of maturity, so that you can look. And this process is going on. You're collecting all the time and trying to disperse at the same time. But don't ever forget you're collecting at the same time. Content of the psyche. See, but when you're mature enough to look at the psychic content, then you can decide what should be gotten rid of. Let it go. When all of these are these, you know how we bundle up hay and there's a fire. You burn them up. That's the end of the world. Where is the world? Is it not part of your psychic content? Yes. That's the end of the world. And then what happens? You have transcended the world. See, always everything comes back to this. What is going on in my house? He that soweth the good seed is the Son of Man. I think all of you can answer that, huh? In the beginning of each of the Gospels, Jesus is referred to as the Son of the Man, as the Son of Man. And in the latter part of the Gospels, of each of the Gospels, he is referred to as the Son of God. What is this all about? Ordinarily, we call ourselves human beings. We are not yet human beings. We are seeds thereof. And it is the Son of Man who soweth the good seed. We are potential We have not yet actualized the Son of Man in ourselves. Some people are not even sprouted, and some people are blossoming. The Son of Man is a human being, and there is only one. The man. A human. This is man actualized. What they call in Zen a finished product. You know, the psyche is finished. It's the end of the world. Now, unless one becomes the Son of Man, one cannot become the Son of God. I mean, in actuality, you can call yourself whatever you want, of course. That's your privilege. That kind of freedom you've got. But in actuality, first actualizes human, and then the next step becomes possible. If you do not understand what is the Son of Man, how can you understand what is the Son of God? We only understand that which has become actual in us, what has become part of us. If you understand love, it is because you have love. And to whatever degree of love, because there's a tremendous number of degrees of love, there's many qualities to it. What has become a part of you, you understand. If it's not part of you, you do not understand it, no matter what you think in here. So now, I ask you, what is this Son of Man? I asked you at the beginning, using different words. And I ask you now. Now, when the Son of Man cometh onto the scene, the tares burn. Because the world is a field. All the world is imaged in you. And in this world, what are you sowing? Sowing seeds of kindness. Sowing, what's that old song? You didn't go to Sunday school? I went to Sunday school. Now, in trying to realize who you are, who are you? What are you? Who are you? In trying to realize who you are, which is the great wealth of all possessions. And it is one you already possess. Little bitty seed, but you possess it. If you are searching in this world for one thing that can be yours, forever and ever, and ever and ever and ever, there's one thing that can be yours, if you're looking for that, with something which even death cannot take from you. Look within. Have you seen something there? Have you had a glimpse of it? Has this light to some degree come into view? If so, then protect it and help it grow. Sitting very quietly with only oneself, not the thoughts, with only oneself, one finds religion. It isn't found in books. It is found in one's own experience with oneself. And we don't need to do a great deal of preparation. You know, first I must be worthy, you know. I must first see that my children are successful. I must first see to my old age. I must first see to this, and I must first see to that, and then I will begin to look. You know, then I can live. After everything is taken care of, then I can live. What are you doing now? You're going to learn to dance with life, huh? Well, first I need a good floor. Let's say a carpentered right so that there's a spring underneath it. Then I can learn to dance, huh? I need also a flowing fountain with it. And, oh, I need this, and I need mirrors, and I need drapes, and, you know, then I can learn to dance. If you want to dance, the earth is enough. Nothing else is needed. Only life flowing through you. And surely, surely, you have that now. Don't you? Yeah, so what is this life? What is it? People talk about surrendering. I'm going to surrender to God. I'm going to surrender this life for that life. It's all one life. Life is life. If you're going to surrender, to what are you going to surrender? To surrender is a happening. And it's a happening in prayer. Using all these examples, I have prefaced this with, You know, in this presence. You know? One can let go, because this presence is so solid and you can trust it so. Well, and I say it's a happening, and so people think, well, it's a happening, so I'll wait for it to happen. Yeah, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. And surely what she said was wrong. I'll go make it happen. No way can you make it happen. The problem is that we wait, and we wait as we are. We don't look to the tares and the wheat in the field. We wait just exactly as we are. Maybe it hasn't happened because of the way we are. If you wait in the same old way, how's it going to happen? If you could just add a little gratitude. That's so difficult. Let it just well up a little bit. And it creates this moment when there is a harmony. You're harmonious with yourself when you can say thank you. Surrender and letting go is not something you learn out of a book again, And just because I stay here and say, let go, doesn't mean that you can do it. No. Who's going to learn it? Who's going to learn to let go, You? Well, you're the barrier. Who's going to practice all this letting go? Well, practice is practiced by the ego, isn't it? Yeah. This is something you have to allow, and it comes from behind the barrier. You know, there is an old quote out of the Bible. Every knee shall bend, and every tongue confess. We have to give way. We are the stubborn ones. We are the prideful ones. We are the arrogant ones. We prevent. You know, sitting for meditation, meditation being such a state in itself, we call it sitting for. We don't say practicing for, we're sitting for. But it's like sitting in your room, and all the doors and windows are closed and the lights are off. So it's dark in that room. And door opens a little bit. When that door opens, the light comes in, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You're not bringing it in. How can you bring in the light? All you do is open the door. You open the door, it comes in. Coming in happens. It's a happening. See? To let go. No longer having defenses. And you would be surprised at the defenses you have got. You let go of your attitudes. Never mind what you approve of, and never mind what you disapprove of. Let it all go. It's not important, you know, in this instance, when you're sitting for meditation. And if you've let all that go, what is left? An empty cup. And only when a cup is empty can it be filled. You cannot force the universe into your filled cup. He who hath ears, let him hear. And again he said, the kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure hid in a field, the which, when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he has, and buyeth that field.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.